What a motley looking crowd. The only way I can be here, when Bill asked me 3 years ago was to take my vacation at this time, we work on weekends. And this is the third time, so when I leave you today, I'm heading for Florida for 3 weeks. But anyway, I'm used to Sunday meeting crowds, you know, with their Sunday meeting vest on and the wives and the kids and everybody pumped up to look holy, and I preach sermons. And I've been doing that for 35 years. And when I was first ordained, I was a teacher in Cleveland, Ohio. I belong to a group called Maris Priests, and we have a big school in Atlanta. We have a big school up in Cleveland. And so I was teaching in high school for about 5 or 6 years, and then they sent me to the university in Washington. I taught at Catholic U. So you see, I teach, I can give lectures, and I preach, and I can preach a hell of a sermon. But I can't do that here with you. I can't lecture you, and I can't preach. And so there's a kind of specific type of communication that goes on in AA that's really kind of mystical. And it's mystical because it's very vulnerable. You know, and when you get up in front of a crowd like this, you'll do it. You'll do it in your own group. You'll be called on to speak. You feel like you're going to streak down Peachtree Road. It's scary. And it's exciting. It's very challenging. And you don't want to do it, but you know you need to do it. And there's a difference between wants and needs. So I need to be with you this morning. I need to share with you this morning because I'm very intellectual and I'm highly educated and I lie. And because of my intellect and my education, I lie well. I mean, I can seduce myself into anything. I start believing it. My counselor in treatment said, he said, Ed, we don't lie, we just enhance reality. And I do a good job on that. Frankly, if I stay away from 3 days from a meeting, it starts. The tapes start up in my brain, and they're good tapes, and I start listening to them, and I start believing them, and I can feel myself falling apart and wonder why. Because I'm not honest. I'm just not honest. I'm an alcoholic. I'm Ed, and I'm an alcoholic. I have been, I am, and I always will be an alcoholic. And when I first found that out, I felt like I had an albatross of shame and guilt tied around my neck. I was in the pits. I was a class act drunk. I didn't slur words. I didn't miss meetings. I had no DUIs. I've never been arrested. It was coming. I was already up to a fifth a day, drinking round the clock every 2 hours, sitting alone in my study at 2 a.m. watching some dumb movie on TV with a jelly glass of scotch by my side, hoping it would put me to sleep. Had I not been intervened, I would have died. When you stand in my presence and you speak of walking into AA meetings on your own or picking up the phone and calling a friend, I say, holy hell, how did he do that? I could never have done that, never have done that. I counsel people and I would say to them, I said, I think you have an alcoholic problem. I think you have a problem with alcohol. My dad was alcoholic. And there's a woman in the parish who works at Charter Peaceford, and I'd refer them. And she would say, thank you, Father Ed, you know, and she'd take charge and get the person into recovery. And I'd go back to my room and drink scotch. Lots of mouthwash, and then I'd come out and counsel the next one and say, I think you got a problem with alcohol. My secretary, her husband was a recovering alcoholic. She saw it in me. And she would try to drop hints, you know, and I saw and I heard the hints, but my denial was like the vault door at Fort Knox. My religious superior came from Washington to talk to me, and I verbally put him through a wall. My sister is a psychiatric nurse, and she said to me, I drove up to Pittsburgh on vacation, and Mom and Dad were still living, and this was back around 1972. And I didn't get into the program until 1987. And Mary walked across the street to help me up the house with the luggage, and Mom and Dad are standing up on the front porch, and Eddie's home for vacation, and Mary came over and gave me a big hug, and she said, come on, I'll help you up with your bags. And I opened up the trunk, and there was a case of 4 half-gallons of gin. And she said, Ed, what in God's name are you doing with 4 half-gallons of gin? I said, Mary, I'm on vacation. She picked up a bag and went up the house, and for the next several days she watched me, breakfast, lunch, supper, evening, sitting on the porch. I was never without a glass in my hand. Always trying to push alcohol on other people. Staring at them when they didn't finish what they drank, you know, what they took. How do you leave a drink that drunk? You know, you don't do that. After about 3 days, she said, Ed, you're an alcoholic. Whew, boy, I verbally put her through a wall. And so it went on, year after year after year, getting worse and worse and worse. And I realized something was wrong, but I didn't know what. Certainly it wasn't the alcohol. But then I started to realize it was the alcohol, and it was too late. I couldn't stop. I used to smoke 2 to 3 packs a day. I quit cigarettes about 20 years ago, and it was hell on earth to quit cigarettes. But I did it, but I couldn't quit drinking. I couldn't drink it. I had to run around Atlanta to buy scotch. I was on scotch by that time at different liquor stores because you're a clergyman. You don't buy it in the same store all the time. They'll start talking, you know. And then how do you get rid of all the empties at a rectory? So I'd put them in paper bags and stash them in the trunk of my car till my trunk was loaded with empties and drive up 75-85 to a rest area and dump them in a dumpster. And when people would say, you have a problem with alcohol, who, me? I was a closet drinker for the most part. And I was scared. I was getting terrified. I had blackouts galore. Memos, write it down. I was pastor. Write it down. There's too much on my brain. I can't remember it all. Write it down. And I'd write it down, I'd forget the memos. And I was terrified. I didn't know what was happening. But I couldn't stop drinking. In fact, I, frightened as I was, and it was fear to the point of terror, if I stopped drinking, it went beyond terror. I would implode, explode, annihilate. How do you live without booze? How do you live without it? It wasn't my problem, for God's sake. It was the only answer. Everything else had failed me, including God. It was my answer. The only spirit I ever found in my life was embottled. And it worked. God, it worked. As long as I drank enough of it. And then it stopped working. And that's like the ultimate betrayal. And there's nowhere to go after that. I was suicidal. I was too chicken to blow my brains out. It was a Thursday. It was noon. I knocked off at the desk, went back to my room, and watched the 12 o'clock news, get ready for lunch, pouring a glass of scotch. The jug was half empty, and I'm saying to myself, my God, I've got to stop this. It was not a prayer, it was profane. But where do I buy the next one? This one's getting empty. That was Thursday. Sunday night, I was intervened. They set it up. My boss, a man from Washington, one of our priests who's in the program, he's our troubleshooter. My secretary, others, 5 people. It was an ordinary Sunday. Busy, busy, busy. It was 5 o'clock, and I heard that Father Leo. I heard that Leo was in town, you know, and naive me, you know, drunk. We're dumb. And I thought, well, I'll call Leo and get him out to dinner. He was in Atlanta for me. He was sent by the boss to set up the intervention for me. So I'm stirring up the beans and wieners about 5:30 with a glass of scotch in my hand. The phone rang. It was Leo. And he says, I said, Leo, welcome to Atlanta. Let's go out to dinner. He said, why don't you come over? We'll talk about it. I said, okay. Finished the scotch, got in the car, drove over to Marist School. rang the doorbell, and the lady from Peachford opened the door. Oh, shit. And I knew right there, I knew it's over. They found out. Come in, Father Ed, we want to talk to you. And I walked in and five people were sitting semicircular and I sat down in the chair. One after another, highly rehearsed, you know, interventions are very delicate. They were terrified that my denial would put them through a wall. But they had no idea how utterly collapsed I was within. And they started, and they cried, they wept, they protested their love. Please don't die, live, we love you, you know. I didn't know that Leo already had the one-way airline tickets in his pocket to Minnesota. You don't argue when you're religious, you know, you follow the boss's orders, but I didn't know that. No. And so all five of them spoke of specific instances of my drinking and everything. I lost my voice. I just sat there and just shook my head. It was over. It was over. It was over. I had been there and back, and it was more of the same, and I couldn't go on, and I didn't want to go on. Where's the coffin? For God's sake, open the lid, and I'll crawl in. It's finished. It's finished. I was robotic. I was like a zombie. When I nodded my head, they jumped up and hugged and kissed and rushed me out into a car and grabbed a toothbrush and on 85 down to Hartsfield to the Holiday Inn, and I sat all night in the room by myself staring at the wall. The cold sweat, I could not sleep. I couldn't get undressed. I just stared at the wall. It's over. I'm disgraced. I failed my whole life. I was 60 years old. I worked my tail off and it's gone. Disgrace my family, my name, my person, my life is over. It's finished. There is no bottom to our bottoms. And I had gone pretty low. And I could have gone lower. No doubt. Leo knocked at the door. He says, "How are you?" I was bathed in a cold sweat. He said, "You want a drink?" I said, No, I don't drink. Leave me alone. 5 in the morning, he knocked at the door. I opened the door. He says, "You didn't go to bed?" I said, "No." He says, "You want a drink?" I said, "No." They were afraid I'd go into DP. We got in a jitney. We went over the airport. 6:30 flight to St. Paul. Who's standing there but some guy from the parish? Oh, hell. "Father Ed, what are you doing here?" "You're going to St. Paul?" "Yes, I have business up there." "Oh, me too." Got on the plane, flew to St. Paul. We got to St. Paul, the bars were opening up. It was 8 o'clock in the morning, and Leo says, "You want a drink?" I said, "No." Waited an hour for a shuttle to fly down to Rochester, Minnesota. We clergy have our own treatment centers. 3 months minimum. 90 meetings, 90 days. Because we're too intellectual, too educated for the program. We try to figure it out. Most professionals do. We are the people who want to take the rose apart to find out why it's beautiful. Some of you can relate to that. I got in the Rochester and the van was there. And Leo says, "Hi, John," the old timer that drove the van. He says, "Here's Father Ed. He's going to be with us for a while." Leo stayed with me for a week. We got to the treatment center, and I walked in, very nice place, and they're all clergy, and they all came up, you know, very kindly. They're already into the program, and, "Oh, you're going to like it here. Come on, it's going to be okay." It was like a lot of freaks to me. They were happy. I do counseling. I looked over the counselors, we're all laymen, and they're all recovering alcoholics. And I looked them over, and I knew which one I would choose and which one I wouldn't. I'm a manipulator, and I knew which ones I could manipulate and which ones I couldn't. I looked at that one, I thought, "Oh, that son of a bitch, no way." They took me over to the Mayo Clinic and put me through a lot of medical tests and psychological tests. 3 days later, the head honcho had my dossier. And he said, "Father Ed, will you sign on as a patient?" And he showed me my scores of psychological tests, and they were those of a mongoloid. And I said, "They can't be my scores. They're not my scores." He said, "Yes, they are." I said, "They can't be." He said, "They're toxic." He said, "What are you talking about? This is Wednesday. I haven't had a drink since Sunday." He says, "Father Ed, it's going to take at least 6 months to get the residuals of alcohol out of your body. You're toxic. You are intoxicated. You're under the influence 24 hours a day." I didn't understand what he was saying, but the scores were astronomically low. And the enzymes from the liver and everything, it's diagnostic. And he said, "Will you sign on as a patient?" And I was, I thought, "Oh God, this is chicken shit. He's talking popcorn. You want me to, with thinly veiled contempt, you know, you want me to say I'm an alcoholic? You know, God, there's so much wrong with me. Alcohol's my answer, not my problem." And I guess I didn't veil the contempt too well. I looked at him and I said, "You want me to say I'm an alcoholic?" Hells, Bill, I'd have said anything at that point. "Do you want me to say I'm an alcoholic?" And the man looked at me. He's the head honcho. He had all the compassion in his eyes that I've ever seen in the eyes of a human being. And he says, "No, Ed." He says, I just want you to admit to the pain you have lived with all your life, and you think alcohol is your answer." My God, a little glimmer of hope started. And I said, "How do you know that? How do you know that?" He said, "Because I'm an alcoholic. I've been there." I said, "Give me the pen, give me the pen." And I signed. And that was the beginning. That was the beginning. I went through the motions for several weeks, willing to do whatever they said, listening, not understanding much at all. Overwhelmed with guilt and shame, I could not buy the concept of disease. I thought that was cute. I was a man of weak will. I had no character, no backbone. The very thing I hated most in my father I had become. I was a failure. I was a disgrace. It was about the third week, and my counselor was Bob Martin, the son of a bitch I'd never have chosen. And I said to him, "Bob, with all due respect," he was hammering away at disease, and I said, "With all due respect, you know, I would not have chosen you as my counselor." And he said, "We knew that." He said, "You're a patient. You don't choose your counselor." And he was exactly what I needed. And he was hammering away at disease, and he stood up, and he hovered over me like this, and he said, "Look, Ed," he says, "I'm getting tired. You're so damn thick. Have you ever come home to Ed Murray and felt at home? Have you ever put your arms around Ed Murray and thank God for making you Ed Murray? Have you ever had a love affair with yourself? Or have you always lived in that yin-yang of duality, the persona out here and the can of worms within, hoping to God nobody ever saw it too deeply within you, trusting no compliment, believing no one's love?" He's hovering over me, and I'm looking at him. My God. And he said, "If you sit in a chair for any length of time and you have no comfort, you're in a state of discomfort. Have you ever been at ease being you? Or have you pathologically, since day one, been ill at ease being you? And if so, you are in a state of dis-ease. And you've had a drug to put you at peace." Oh, my
That's what you mean by disease.
Yes, and you've got it.
Wow. Wow. He says it's a disease.
Now, if you want to go on in this tootsie sadomasochism of blame and shame, go right ahead. He says, but now you understand. You're one sick cookie. And he was right. It's a subtle way of flattering one's ego, you know, to take responsibility for one's alcoholism. I didn't do it. And it wasn't done to me. It's a disease, pure and simple. And I have it. And it's a family thing. My family's riddled with it. Uncles, aunts, grandparents, it's all over the place. That was the beginning. That was the beginning. Then I started becoming more docile, more less argumentative, less intellectual. You cannot take your gallbladder up to your intellect and say, take care of these stones. You can't take gas pains up to your intellect and say, take care of these pains. Neither can you take alcoholism up to your intellect and say, figure it out. Solve it. We don't have problems to be solved. We don't have an attitude to be changed. We have a disease that needs to be treated. And the only treatment available on planet Earth is a 12-step program divined by two prophets, Bill Bevy and Dr. Bob. And it's God inspired. It's God inspired. I was in treatment about 3-4 weeks, I think it was. It was snowing. It was late November, Minnesota. And I was sitting at my desk. And it started to happen. Don't ask me what it is. It started to happen. And I stood up and I said, what is this? I felt so wonderfully relaxed, so glowing within. And I opened the door and walked out to the hall and walked up and down the hall, and I thought, holy smokes, there was a song in my heart. It felt like a melody at last had found its lyric. I felt like my heart was sliding into a fur-lined slipper. It's what I always pursued every time I took a drink and never found. I walked down the stairs and I felt like dancing, and I his door was open, Bob. And I knocked at the door, and he says, come in. And he says, what is it? And he says, I see it in your face. I said, Bob, what is it? He said, it's called serenity. Have you ever experienced that in your life? I said, no. Is it real? He said, yes, it's real. It's what it means to be alive. It's what it means to be to be healthy, to be normal. Have you ever experienced it? I said, no. He said, hang on to it. It won't last. He said, it will come now and then, but you're on your way. Now you know. There's no way you can explain this anywhere. If you were in the swimming pool and I'm walking by and you invite me in for the swim, and I'll say, no, I've read all the books about swimming. I know swimming, but I've never been in the water. When you get in the water, you get into an empirical knowledge, an experiential knowledge that you can't give to another person. They have to go through it themselves. You've got to walk the walk before you talk the talk. There's no other way. And I began to walk the walk that day. And what a walk it's been. Coming up in a few weeks on 8 years. And it keeps getting better and better. It keeps getting better and better. All my life, I've had God. I was born and raised in a large Catholic family. Mother's parents were from Germany, and Dad's parents were from Irish. My oldest brother was a priest. He died in a car accident. And I loved God. I really did. God was important to my childhood, and then even though I was an adolescent and a young man in the Navy, I didn't have much God about me, but I never doubted God. I went into the seminary when I was 24. And I was ordained when I was 34. And my whole life was committed to proving to God that I could pay the rent for the space I took up on planet Earth. All my life was dedicated to paying the tax or whatever for the air I breathe. I felt I had to justify my existence, and boy, I was going to prove to God that I was worthy of His love, let alone recognition. I felt like God was up there in His celestial penthouse in charge of the corporation called Creation, and I was one of His junior executives, and boy, was He lucky to have me. And I did it up wrong. I was a crack teacher. They put me on the road. I traveled all over the eastern United States on speaking engagements. And I was booked 3 years in advance. Then I got into marriage encounter work, gave over 200 marriage encounter weekends, teaching couples how to talk and listen, did television work. Then I got into parish work. And I kept climbing and climbing, and the higher and higher I got, the less there was up there. And then I got to the top, and there was nothing up there. And work, by the time I was 45, 50 years old, no longer was my drug of choice. It didn't work. So long as I could work and work and work and live on this promise that it will fulfill me, it would pay my debt, it would justify my being, work was my drug of choice. I collapsed with a bleeding ulcer. 3 years later, 6 years later, they carried me out in a state of total exhaustion. The buzzword then was burnout. I was a week in the hospital with that. And after that, it was the martini lunches. It became the martini breakfasts. It became the martini suppers. And it was martinis round the clock. And alcohol worked. Thank God it worked. Because when work failed me, there was nothing left but alcohol. And my counselor said to me in treatment, Ed, at that point in your life, had you not had the alcohol, you would have blown your brains out. The day will come when you'll thank God you had the alcohol. I thought he was an asshole when he said that. But he was right. He was right. You see, and I had to prove it to myself. I was giving a talk not too long ago for AA, and I was sitting at my desk, and you know we're big on ego, rightly so, because it'll kill us. And ego is Latin, it's a pronoun, E-G-O. And we have all these wonderful, wonderful little maxims in AA, easing God out, and that's true. And that's a wonderful, wonderful thing. But there's another pronoun for the I, pronoun. In Latin, it's id, I-D. Freud was big on that, libido and all that. So sitting at my desk, I put that down beside the ego, and as I stared at id, I put a dash after it and put OL. Then I put down the ID and put a dash and put OLATOR. And then I put ID with a dash and I put IOT. And then I put ID with a dash, and I put IOCY, idiocy, and I qualify. And then I heard that voice from Mount Sinai. I am the Lord your God. Don't have a strange God before me, because if you do, you're going to screw it up. And I had a strange God. Remember that bumper sticker you used to see, God is my co-pilot? That's blasphemous. If God's the co-pilot, who's the pilot? I lived like that. I've always had God. It was like God was on the back seat of a bicycle built for two. And I was on the front seat. And if you know anything about a bicycle built for two, you know the guy in the back seat pumps, has handlebars that give him nothing but a place to hold on to. And the guy in the front seat pumps and has handlebars that steer the bike. And I was in the front seat. And God was my co-pilot in the back seat. He was like a hired bodyguard, and I was so pleased to have him. And I kept getting lost, smashing into trees. And this soft, gentle voice would say, "Ed, you want me to drive?" "Oh, no, no, no. You've got enough to do." It's like you when your wife says, "Honey, stop and ask directions." And then I hit the brick wall of alcoholism, and I totaled the bike. And when I woke up, I was on the back seat. And he's on the front seat. And he's steering. And he's pumping. And I say, "But where are we going?" And he says, "Pump." And I say, "Where are we going?" And he says, "Enjoy the ride. Do the next right thing. Pump." And that's it. That second step, I came to believe, oh, did I ever, that a power greater than me can restore me to sanity. But I don't know what the hell sanity is. If I got there, I wouldn't recognize it. I've never been there. It's a destination I'm headed toward. But oh, what a journey. What a journey. And it keeps getting better. It was Wednesday or Thursday. He's right here in the room. He won't mind. My secretary said, "You have a call." And I said, "Well, I'll take a message." She says, "It's long distance." I said, "All right." His name's Tom. He was calling from Tennessee. And he said, "Are you Father Ed?" And I said, "Yes, yes, that's fine. I'm Father Ed." And he says, "You're going to be at the rock?" I said, "Yeah, I'll be at the rock." He says, "Can I see you when you come back?" I said, "Sure." "Fine, yes, man." He says, "I said, well, I never find you, but ask people, don't recognize me, or point me out." And I got here yesterday about 4 o'clock and got in the room up there. And I went down to supper. I had a name tag on. The guy right beside me was Tom. IBM's Itsy Bitsy Miracles. He does it all the time. I was driving out of Atlanta yesterday at 2 o'clock, a little bit on the tired side. I had been rushing around all morning, getting ready for this trip and getting ready for the day, and anxious and anxiety and all that stuff, and it's rainy, and it's miserable, and it's cloudy, and it's gray, and my disease is kicking in. I call them seizures. I can feel it coming on. I'm like an epileptic, you know. An epileptic has a bell in their ear or a light in their eye, and they know they're going to have a seizure. I can feel it coming on. It was coming on, and I was going to let it. Because it was that kind of a day, I deserved a seizure. You know, what a hell of a day, you know. And I had lunch with the two priests I lived with up at Fuddruckers and Perimeter, and they were talking, and my paranoia was in, and I knew they were talking about me and plotting about me, and boy, am I going to get them. And oh, God, the sickness was kicking in. And I'm driving east on 20, you know, and it's really kicking in, and I'm getting off on my misery, and all of a sudden, it dawned on me, he's got the daffodils on the drawing board. The dogwoods are all on the schedule, and the azaleas will bloom in April. He's got a plan. He doesn't take Coffee Bridge. He's right there. There's no loopholes in Providence. Are you the only exception, jerk? I mean, he plots stars in the skies, and he plots tides, and he plots migration of whales and salmon and worms that become butterflies, and he takes care of them all, except you. You're the only exception. And it lifted. And I very gently and peacefully said, "God, I'm sorry." He says, "Okay. It's okay. You see, I entered the seminary in 1950 at the age of 24, and I studied and studied and studied, and summer school, and 10, 11 years of theology, and Bible study, and everything, and preaching, and seminars, and work, and dealing with people, and I know all about God, all this circumferential business about God. It's like me knowing all about you and never having been in touch with you. I was never in touch with God. I didn't know God. I knew all about God. Until I got into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he touched me. It's the only way I can describe it. He touched me. He touched me. He did it that snowy day when I walked down and talked to Bob Martin, my counselor, and he says it's called serenity. I didn't know that was God touching me then. I was only a few weeks ago then. I got out of treatment in March 11th, 1988, after 4 months. I went to Orlando for 4 years in the parish and went on to Rome for my sabbatical, and I went to AA in Rome. That's a kick. People from all over the world, some living in Rome, working there, some tourists. And it's strange. The stories are the same. The dialect, skin color, nationality differs, but the story's the same. It's an incredible thing to go to AA out of town or out of the country. And I was there 6 months on the sabbatical with 25 priests from around the world. For most of them, English was the second or third language. And we were updating. You know, they were giving us stuff. It's like medicine or any other field. You have to keep up with it. And so they're updating it. None of us are ordained less than 25 years. We were trying to find out what's been going on in the church and all this good stuff. And his name was John Schulenbach. He was from Cologne, Germany. He spoke excellent English. And he was one of these top-drawer professors at one of the high-powered universities in Rome. And they brought him down to give us a retreat. And you have to have a lot of savvy in order to hold a clergy audience when you're given a retreat. This man was good. He had that aura about him. He held us spellbound. And after about the third day, he had earned our respect. He certainly had my attention. And the third day, he walked in, and he looked us over. Now, get the audience, 30 men from around the world, all of us Catholic priests, you know, 25 years ordained. He looked us all over. And he started off with these words that Christ used before he went up to his death. When Christ looked at his apostles and wanted to know, did he get through to these guys? And Christ looked at them and he said, and John was using the words. John walked in the room and he looked at us and he said, "Who do you say that I am? Who do you say that I am? Who do you say that I am?" Last night I sat at the fire and I heard you all do that. Who is he? Who is he? And John was saying that. Who do you say that I am? And my mind began to flip. You know, like when you were a kid and you had those little books you flipped with your thumb and it made it look like a movie picture? And my mind started flipping through the pages of theology and philosophy and scripture study and ecclesiology and historicity and the second person was there. And I was going on and on and on and on and on, and suddenly it says, he grabbed me by the shoulders, and he said, "Will you stop dancing around? I'm simply someone who loves you. Will you stop dancing around? I'm simply someone who loves you." Oh, wow. All my life I've been dancing around, trying to be good, trying to be better, trying to be best, trying not to be bad, more often being bad than good, if not better or best. Not worse or worse. Living a contingency between saving my soul and losing my soul and being convinced that I'll probably end up in the latter. And now I discovered, gentlemen, through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, that we don't have to save our souls. We have to find them. We've been disinterred spirits, bodies walking around without any spirituality whatsoever. And without spirituality, there's no spine. Without spirituality, there's no soul. It's not a joke to speak of us when we're embalmed with alcohol as zombies. And what does the program give us? Not a bottled spirit, but an embodied spirit. in you and me and us, like terminals of the battery. When we connect, the juices flow and he gets into the action. That Star Wars marvelous statement when the old timer said to Luke Skywalker, "May the Force be with you." That is Dominus Verbiscum. And that force is alive in every room of AA you walk into. Some meetings suck. But I never walk away from a meeting without a song in my heart. Because he touched me. He touched me again and again. And I cannot live longer than 3 days without that touch. He's simply someone who loves me. Will you stop dancing around? It takes two to make someone. From conception throughout life, you can never, never become a fully developed person until you have a significantly developed other in your life. And I never found that significantly developed other until I got into the halls of AA. His name was Tom in Orlando. I got into Orlando and I looked in the yellow pages and I knew I had to go to meetings. I didn't want to go, but I knew I had to. I was frightened. I didn't know a soul in Orlando. And I was out around Buena Vista there, the Disney area in the parish, and I called AA. And I said that I'm new in town. I'd like to go to a meeting. He says, "Where do you live?" And I says, I don't know. He says, "Are you drinking?" I said, "No. I'm out Buena Vista by Disney." He said, "Okay, get on I-4, go east, get downtown Orlando, go in to on Colonial Drive. There it is, clubhouse, downtown Orlando clubhouse." I'm just out of treatment. I've got this albatross around my neck. You know, I'm an alcoholic. And I walked in, and there's the leather, the chains, the earrings, you know, the street people, the bag ladies, the prostitutes. And I'm sitting there thinking, what in God's name am I doing here? And then they started to talk. And the wisdom out of their mouths, I could be their grandfather. They spoke, how do they know this? How do they know this? And I was one of those early coming really new recovering people that whines, you know, the whiners that always crying. I was one of those. And I was always whining and crying, and so I'd share. And after about a third meeting downtown Orlando, some little old bag lady came up to me. She looked up to me and she said, Son. She said, "Son, you new in the program?" And I said, "Well, yes, I just got out of treatment." And she said, "Well, you're going to come to learn, to discover, that we don't have bad days in the program. We just have learning days." Pain makes us think. Thought makes us wise. Some days recovery sucks. Some of the addictionologists in the field today don't want to call it recovery because it's too analogous to medicine. You get your gallbladder out, you have surgery, you're in the recovery room. And each day in every way you grow better and better, and pretty soon you're eating sauerkraut and pork. And the pain is gone. But not so in recovery from addiction. Recovery is painful, but they're birthing pains. They bring forth new life. No pain, no gain. So don't be afraid of the pain. You're turning a corner. A new you is becoming. I was the kind of guy that always arrived right on the hour. 8 o'clock meeting, I was there at 1:01. As soon as the Our Father was over, boom, I was gone. One night I dared stay a few moments afterwards. That's all God needs is one little break. And this gentleman walked up and said, "Where do you live?" And I said, "Out by Buena Vista, 24 miles away." He said, "You come all the way down here to a meeting?" And I said, "Well, I don't know where else to go." And so he got me the little directory. I didn't know about directory. He said, look, there's a meeting right by your house, you know." And so the next night I went to that meeting right by my house, and there he was. His name's Tom. And I shared, and after the meeting, he walked over and he says, "You new in the program?" And I said, "Yeah." He says, "Yeah, are you some kind of a professional?" And I says, "Yeah, I guess so. I'm a priest." He says, "Oh, hell." I love when you guys bash religion. I understand. But anyway, he said, "Why don't you come back? Why don't you sign here? Make this your home group." And I said, "Wait a minute. I don't want to sign anything, really." "What do you mean, home group? You know, it sounds too cute to me." He says, "Well, you know," he says, "we alcoholics dance around a lot." He says, "We like to sit around different meetings so nobody gets to know us. And we can hand out a lot of bullshit, you know. Like my counselor in treatment, we went out in the van to meetings outside in the evening, and there he was, Bob, that son of a bitch I wouldn't have chosen. He was sitting across the hall, and I shared first week in treatment. And afterwards, everybody came up to me and said, "Oh, wow, it was a wonderful sharing. Yeah, that was really good." "Thank you, yeah. Glad it helped, you know." The next day, I had an appointment with Bob in his office, and I sat down. He said, "Saw you at the meeting last night, Ed." And I said, "Yeah, Bob, I saw you over there, waiting for the accolades." He says, "Ed, when you go to a meeting, you're there not to impress. You're there to express." Turned me into a grease spot, you know. But I was like that. I was sitting around meeting to meeting so nobody would really get to know me. And Tom pinned me down. You hear how God works? It's tricky. We have a sneaky God. And so anyway, I said, okay. So Tom and I got to know each other, and his wife was in the program. We're the best of friends now, the dearest, dearest of friends. And eventually he became my sponsor. I was there 4 years. By the third year in recovery, you know, I was into this, why don't I feel better? I was getting into a lot of rage, a lot of anger, because I had repressed everything since I was a teenager. I was fine. How are you? Fine. I'm fine. I was a can of worms, but I never said that. You know, when it got uncontrollable, I sedated it with alcohol. It was like those monitors you see in ICU when the patient is hooked up. You know, they're going blip, 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 blip. You know they're alive. When they flatline, they're dead. As long as I had alcohol in me, I could flatline. It was wonderful. Take the alcohol away, and I was flip, 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 flipping all over the damn wall. And by the third year, I couldn't stand it. If this is recovery, screw it. Who needs it? And I had to go back for aftercare for a week. And I told her about it, a woman, counselor. She said, "Well, you're in relapse." I said, "What are you talking about? I haven't had a drink." She said, "No, but you will." I said, but, she says, "No." She says, "You're into all this negativity and all this criticism." She says, "Your disease is kicking in full gear." And then we had all these workshops on relapse. And I said, "Oh, my God." And I started learning. God, it was impossible. It was impossible. I could never have done this myself. Never. And God, along the way, has put all the significant people that I've ever needed right on stage, right on cue, right at the moment I needed them. I came back to Atlanta, went on 5 years ago. They brought me right back to the parish where I once was pastor, back to the scene of the crime. And the people welcomed me with open arms. And I fooled around without a sponsor for 3 years. For 3 years. Oh, I'd talk, and I'd talk to a lot of people, and I'd call Tom long distance. And I'd tell everybody else, "You better get a sponsor, better get a sponsor." And I didn't have a sponsor. And a couple of years ago, this guy, his name is Bill, asked me to sponsor him. He had about two or three sponsors. I said, "All right." And he was a real gifted person. And so we worked very hard together. And it was just last February, March, I asked him to be my sponsor. And he said, "I will, provided it doesn't destroy our friendship." He said, "Let me think about it." So we agreed to try it. And then the first thing he asked me to do was a fourth step. I had done one in treatment, the Goody Two-Shoes Catholic Little General Confession about sin. Fourth step is not a guilt trip. It's a trip around the moon to find out what your shadowed self is all about. That's what it is. It's a trip into self-discovery. You can't do that alone. You need somebody to hold your hand. And then the fifth step, we work through the fifth step. And now, I'm like an open book for the first time in my life. We lifted every rock. This was the third time I did the fourth step, and I did it. Big book, columns start with repentance. And we got to that last column. What part did I have to play in all this? What part did I have to play in all this? Mom and Dad, I had down there, I was a child, I could not process, But then I get into all my adult shit, you know, and I had all this victim, martyr, poor me stuff, and Bill slammed his hand down on that last column, and he said, your best thinking got you here, Mr. Intellect. And he said, you made a choice. You made a choice. And I said, what are you talking about, a choice? I was powerless. He said, you chose not to choose. And that's a choice. Oh, my God. And slowly I started getting honest and realized I have no one to blame. I have no one to shame. I have only myself. And I cannot blame and shame myself again. My face is being rubbed into the fact that I am one sick cookie. I have a disease. The presence or the absence of the alcohol is quite accidental. I haven't had a drop of alcohol in my body for 8 years, and I am an alcoholic. So alcohol is not a causal factor in my disease. If anything, it was an illusion of a remedy. I am an alcoholic. And left of my own devices, I will act accordingly. There was a little boy who woke up in the dead of night, and he was terrified. He had a dream, frightened him. He screamed. His mother came in to put the light on to console him. She hugged and kissed him. She did all the wonderful things that mothers can do with frightened children. She tucked him in, told him a story, said prayers with him. He snuggled in. She went to the door to put the light out and closed the door behind her. And she said, don't be afraid, Johnny. God's with you. And Johnny looked up and said, yeah, Mommy, but I need somebody with skin on him. I never found that until I found the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. In the strangest ways, unprecedented ways, there's a literal collage of people in the past 8 years that have walked through and touched me, and I knew that he had touched me. Where are we going? He says, pump. Where are we going? He says, pump. I came across this. It takes me a minute to read it, but it's utterly beautiful. Wayne Dyer's book, The Sacred Self. He opens with this. Dear reader, imagine this scene, if you will. Two babies are in utero in the womb, confined to the wall by a cord to their mother's womb. They're having a conversation. For the sake of clarity, we'll call these twins ego and spirit. And spirit says to ego, I know you're going to find this difficult to accept, but I truly believe there's life after birth. Ego responds, don't be ridiculous. Look around you. This is all there is. Why must you always be thinking about something beyond this reality? Accept your lot in life. Make yourself comfortable. Forget about all that life after birth nonsense. Spirit quiets down for a while, but her inner voice will not allow her to remain silent any longer. Ego, now don't get mad, but I have something else to say. I also believe there is a mother. A mother? Ego guffaws.
How can you be so absurd? You've never seen a mother. Why can't you accept that this is all there is? The idea of a mother is crazy. You're here alone with me. This is your reality. Now grab hold of that cord. Go into your corner. Stop being so silly. Trust me. There is no mother. Spirit reluctantly stops her conversation with Ethan. But her restlessness soon gets the better of her. Ego, she implores, please listen without rejecting my idea. Somehow I think that those constant pressures we both feel, those movements that make us so uncomfortable sometimes, that continual repositioning and all that closing in that seems to be taking place as we keep growing, is getting us ready for a place of glowing light. We will experience it very soon. Now I know you're absolutely insane, replies Ego. All you've ever known is darkness. You've never seen light. How can you even contemplate such an idea? Those movements and pressures you feel are your reality. You are a distinct, separate being. This is your journey. Darkness and pressure and a closed-in feeling, that's what life is all about. You'll have to fight it and endure it as long as you live. Now grab hold of your cord and please stay still. The spirit relaxes for a while. But finally she can contain herself no longer. Ego, I have only one more thing to say. And then I'll never bother you again. Oh, go ahead, Ego responds impatiently. I believe all of these pressures and all of this discomfort is not only going to bring us to a new celestial light, but when we experience it, we're going to meet Mother face to face and know all the ecstasy that is beyond anything we have ever experienced up till now. You really are crazy, Spirit. Now I'm convinced of it. And he said to me, you stop dancing around. I'm simply someone who loves you. Faith. When you've come to the edge of all the light you know and are about to step into the darkness of the unknown, faith is knowing one of two things will happen. There will be something solid to stand on, or you'll be taught to fly. There was a little pond. It was not much of a pond. It was not very deep. And there were a lot of water bugs scurrying about mindlessly in their daily muddied existence on the bottom of the pond. And every once in a while, one of the bugs would climb up the stem of water, one of the water plants and disappear and never come back. And so the mayor of the little water bug community called for a town hall meeting one night, and he said, now look here, if you guys want to climb up the stems of one of those plants, fine and good, but you've got to come back down here and tell us what's up there. And so one day Billy Bug, his curiosity overcoming his fear, screwed up all his courage and climbed up the stem of one of the water plants. And when he got up there, he found a lily pad. He crawled out on the lily pad, and for the first time in his life, he felt the warmth of the April sun and the sweet-scented air of spring, and he grew drowsy, and he fell asleep. He slept a long, long time. And when he woke up, Billy Bug had this uncontrollable urge to stretch, and when he did, he found he had wings. Billy Bug had become a dragonfly. He fluttered his wings and he flew off into the sunlight and the sweet-scented air of April. And he was having a wonderful time soaring here and there. And then he said to himself, oh, I've got to go back down there and tell them what's up here. And try as he could not penetrate the surface of the water.
And so he flew off into the sunlight. And he said to himself, well, I guess they're just going to have to come up here themselves and find out what it's all about. He had been taught how to fly. Faith, it's a leap into an abyss, trusting that arms will catch you. And oh, what a surprise there is when you're caught. And because of faith, there is success in failure. And now, let me close with this. There's a house engulfed in flame at 2 a.m. And the father and mother woke up and gathered the children, hysterically panicked. They flee the house. In the confusion of smoke and fire and flame and crowds and fire engines and police, there's a pipey little voice at the upstairs window screaming at the top of his lungs, Daddy, 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 Johnny's been overlooked. Daddy races across the terrace, tries to enter the flame-engulfed house. It's too intense. He can't get in. He goes over to the terrace. He looks up. He knows his son is at that window. He cannot see him because of smoke and flame and fire. And he cries out, jump, Johnny, jump, I'll catch you. Jump, Johnny, jump, I'll catch you. Johnny can hear his father call. But he cannot see him because of the smoke and flame. Jump, Johnny, jump, I'll catch you. If Johnny jumps, his father will catch him. If Johnny doesn't jump,